President Obama and his administration have attempted quite actively to put a stamp of legitimacy on policies that, if John McCain had won the election in 2008 or Mitt Romney in 2012, many liberals would be up in arms about. And what I the challenge that I think this era really poses, the Obama era, to people of conscience is that it's going to test your actual principles. It's very easy to be against war or against U.S. policies when someone like Dick Cheney is in power. And I mean, I actually do think of Dick Cheney as an evil cartoon character type person, where I wouldn't be surprised if we found out that Dick Cheney spends two-thirds or more of the year in a cave actively thinking on how to fuck up the world. I don't think that Barack Obama is that kind of person. But the point that I'm making is that, you know, a lot of liberals supported Barack Obama through both elections. And, you know, I'm not here to debate electoral politics. I personally think we should abolish the two-party system. And in order to do that, we would need to get huge corporations out of our campaigns. But the real world that we're living in right now is that most people, including probably a majority of people of good faith, think, well, I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Or they actively believed that what Obama said he was going to do, he was going to do. And so if you're one of those people, if you voted for him, if you believed any of that, or if you felt like you were just holding your nose and voting for the Democrats because you don't want Republicans to choose Supreme Court justices for reasons that have to do with women's health care access or any other issue, then you have a special responsibility to show where your principles lie. And so if you were against endless war when Bush and Cheney were doing it, you can't now say, well, because Obama's in office, I trust the endless war. And that's actually what a lot of the argument is boiled down to. If you're out in the public debating these issues, and as I am often, you'll have people say, well, I just trust Obama. No, I wouldn't want Mitt Romney to be in charge of the drone program, but I just trust Obama. Well, newsflash, there's no such thing as a Democratic predator and a Republican predator. There's no such thing as a Democratic cruise missile or a Republican cruise missile. These are all U.S. cruise missiles that are funded by U.S. taxpayers that are being deployed with the consent and authorization, in many cases, of lawmakers who have been sent to Congress by people who voted for them in their districts, and the trigger is being pulled at the end of the day by a president who won a Democratic election two times over. You have a special responsibility, if that's your guy, and you think he's a better alternative to the Republicans, to actually speak up when it matters. You know, I was saying last night, if you're a vegetarian, you know, you want to claim to be a vegetarian, it's easy to be a vegetarian between meals. It's also, you know, very easy to be, you know, anti-war between elections or against U.S. militarism between elections. What it really matters is, what are your principles when you go to vote for these people? And if they do win, and in some degree you've held your nose or you think they're a better alternative, then when they get into power and they mimic what the people you said you didn't want to be in power are doing, then you have a special obligation to stand up and speak out against it in real time. Not just say, oh, well, I don't want to risk that we're going to lose it because we don't want to criticize the Democrats in fear of the Republicans losing. The fact is that the right in this country has been very effective at pulling the Democrats further to the right and the Republicans further into insanity Donald Trump territory. And so people who actually believe in justice are sort of left playing defense constantly during elections. Now, the reason that I'm talking about all of this is because what I think the enduring legacy of the Obama administration is going to be when it comes to the issues that I cover, war, so-called counterterrorism, so-called national security, is that he has ensured that the posture that the United States has a right to bomb any country that it wishes to bomb in the name of protecting itself, that the United States has a right to conduct assassination operations in any country around the world that it pleases, that the United States has the right to claim humanitarian motivation or national security to justify any manner of U.S. militarism, that is going to be a permanent institution for many generations to come because Barack Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, because Barack Obama is a constitutional lawyer, because Barack Obama has an infinitely firmer grasp of the English language than his predecessor, because Barack Obama can be a very likable person who, when he is standing up for a principle, a lot of people get behind him. But he has put a stamp of legitimacy on what amounts to a global assassination program. And that means that the next time a Republican comes into office, the Democrats and many liberals who stood by silently and watched the drone program expand, watch us launch multiple new wars, are going to have very shaky ground to stand on if they try to go back to their pre-Obama position of we're against these things. So if you want to talk about what happened under the Bush era, we can talk until the cows come home about the criminality and the fact that it was basically murder incorporated. What they did to the country of Iraq when they launched their invasion and occupation, which, by the way, was supported at the time by then-Senator Joe Biden and then-Senator Hillary Clinton. In fact, most of the Democrats in the Congress were on board with the Bush administration when they launched their endless war after 9/11. It's boring to just sort of talk about Bush and Cheney. We know that they were acting in a criminal capacity around the world. I'm more interested in talking about the people that claim to represent an alternative. For young people who have grown up in the shadow of 9/11, you have never known a state in the United States other than this sort of permanent state of war, where even just the slightest whiff of a terror threat, you're told is like a volcano ready to erupt. And the whole thing is just bullshit. Terrorism is a real threat, but it is a relatively minor threat compared to everything else we face in our society. The economic condition of working class and poor people in this country is a greater threat to our security than any act of terrorism organized by some loonies in the mountains of Yemen. More people die of bee stings, and I was saying this last night, more people in this country die of bee stings every year than they do from terrorist attacks. And yet it's only Monsanto that's talking about killing all of the bees. But that's essentially what our counterterrorism policy boils down to, that we have embraced a system where the only beneficiaries are large war corporations and weapons manufacturers, where we are responding to a relatively minor threat of international terrorism by bombing, invading, occupying, assassinating, and in the process, we have come to a point where we are creating more new enemies every day than we are killing anyone that is posing an imminent threat to our country or to U.S. citizens around the world. And I'm not a nationalist at all. I don't believe that American lives are worth a penny more than non-American lives. But the reason that I say that is because that is the way it's framed in the public discourse. And I think we don't even need to be internationalists to win that argument against the militarists, because I actually think that our counterterrorism policy is even against the national interest of Americans in terms of financial costs, but also in terms of security costs. When you are engaged in a war, which is asymmetric, where you have your military, your bombs, and your guns, and your forces pummeling people whose weapons are from a different century, then you look like a gratuitous enemy. Then you are sending a message that we will go to the extreme to murder your whole family if we intercept a call where you're talking about possibly one day sending a package bomb to the United States. We have radically overreacted and in the process have given the very forces that we claim to be fighting an incredible propaganda moment where they can point to civilians killed in drone strikes, to the orange jumpsuits at Guantanamo, to the secret CIA prison sites. We have a situation where those people that they claim to be fighting, whether it's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whoever the terrorist flavor of the month is right now, where we're handing them a sort of propaganda victory. But there's another part to this, which is that if you look at the origins of ISIS, you know, we were told that bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were this huge threat. And then Osama bin Laden gets killed, and then they say, well, there's these splinter groups that are now rising up, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Then it was Al-Shabaab is this great threat. Then we had ISIS, and then ISIS went away for a little while because they had this new Khorasan group that they brought out, and nobody hears anything about the Khorasan group anymore because that was just a one-week special in the terrorism shop. And now we're back to ISIS is this great threat. What is ISIS? How was ISIS created? First of all, if you look at the actual history of resistance movements in Iraq post-U.S. invasion, Let me just run through a little bit of this history because it never makes it into the newspapers. I spent a lot of time in Iraq during the 1990s, and I traveled all throughout the country. And I interviewed many of the top officials within Saddam Hussein's government. I interviewed many tribal leaders in Western Iraq. I traveled to the Shia holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. I was in Basra. And I spoke to Iraqis all over the country. And when the U.S. invaded Iraq, they put in charge of the occupation a man named Paul Bremer, who was a neoconservative who worked in risk analysis and management and terrorism securities. So a guy who was making money off of the threat of terrorism around the world then was put in charge of Iraq to manage that country and to rebuild it in the image of some sort of Milton Friedman wet dream. And so Paul Bremer, who cut his teeth working under Henry Kissinger, who is perhaps one of the most vicious war criminals in modern world history, is then sent to be in charge of Iraq. And they ran it in an ideological way that they would run the volunteer sessions at the Republican National Convention, where they literally took interns who knew nothing about Iraq, not to mention their own country, and stuck them in key positions. And one of the first things that Paul Bremer, one of the first ideas that Paul Bremer unleashed on Iraq was the idea that the Ba'ath Party was a modern historical equivalent to the Nazi Party, and that Saddam Hussein was a modern historical equivalent to Adolf Hitler. And what they did is they the first order that they implemented was an order that called for de-Ba'athification. That meant that they wanted to destroy the Ba'ath Party. And what they said is that anyone in the Iraqi military who is an active member of the Ba'ath Party can no longer be in the Iraqi military. Well, the vast majority of Iraqis who were in the military had to be members of the Ba'ath Party as a prerequisite just to survive in that country. I mean, there were so many people that were members of the Ba'ath Party that probably despised the Ba'ath Party, but it was part of surviving in that society. If you wanted to work in the public sector, if you wanted to be a teacher, if you wanted to be an engineer, you just had to sign the paper. It's not to say that there weren't enthusiastic Ba'athists, but most Iraqis who wanted to work and have some kind of livelihood had to agree to that. And so they purged 250,000 Iraqi soldiers, many of them Sunnis, from the Iraqi military and fired them on the spot very early on in the U.S. occupation. Then thousands and thousands of those soldiers who were laid off, including their commanding officers and others, marched on the Green Zone, demanding to be reinstated in the Iraqi military. Because remember, Sunnis are a minority in Iraq, even though and Saddam Hussein was a minority in Iraq who was running the country through a sort of iron fist of dictatorship and militarism. If the United States wanted to, quote unquote, win the occupation of Iraq, the way they could have done it is to decapitate the regime, kill Saddam Hussein, replace all of the heads of the Mukhabarat and the military with people who were loyal to the United States, and the Iraqi military, especially the Sunnis in it, were loyal to the state establishment of the military, and would have probably flipped right away and worked with the Americans. Iraq had a secular tradition. It was a well-educated country that had a far greater orientation toward the West than a lot of other countries in the region. But Bremer was so obsessed with crushing what he perceived to be the ideology rather than a state apparatus of repression against its own people that he fires all of these military guys. They then are demonstrating and saying, you're making a huge mistake. We're career military. We aren't Saddam loyalists. You should hire us. And they said, no. One U.S. official at the time said that when Bremer did that, it was the day we made 250,000 armed enemies in Iraq. And so what you saw happen was the Sunnis, particularly in Western Iraq, began a massive uprising against the occupation. For the first year of the occupation, there was brutality, there was killing. All of that is true. But a year into it was when the flames started to really spread around the country. And so you had this resistance coming out of Western Iraq that was largely centered around the Sunnis who were fired by Paul Bremer from the military. Then you had the Shia movement under Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army start to implement social services in areas that had been systematically targeted by Saddam Hussein. And they started to organize under a sort of nationalist banner. And actually, when Fallujah was under siege, Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army organized blood drives to send blood into the areas where Sunnis were resisting the U.S. occupation. So the Americans had this moment where they, through their own policies, had created what was starting to look like a national uprising in Iraq. And it's not that Muqtada al-Sadr had anything in common with the Anbar tribes. It was that they both realized that they had a common enemy. And so they were fighting against the occupation. And so what the Americans did, which is a classic technique that goes out throughout history, is they wanted to divide and conquer. So they started to fund death squads and organize them under the auspices of the Ministry of the Interior in Iraq. And so they had Shia-led death squads that were going into predominantly Sunni areas with a mandate to just clean the areas. Then the Sunnis started to get funding from outside in Western Iraq, and they started going in and trying to ethnically cleanse Shias. And I should say also that I'm oversimplifying, by the way, the Shia-Sunni Kurdish reality in Iraq at that time, because there was so much intermarriage. And so when I'm referring to Sunni or Shia, I'm talking about the way that people were forced into one corner and to choose one side of their family versus another if they were in mixed families. But that would create a very complicated, long conversation. But the short of it was that the United States, just as it did in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, wanted to create these small, ethnically clean para-states so that they could keep Iraq divided so that Iraq could be conquered. And to sort of fast forward a bit, when al-Qaeda in Iraq started to rise and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was cutting off people's heads and killing American contractors and what have you, the United States, in a way to fight foreign fighters that were coming to Iraq, started to pay then the Sunni tribes in Western Iraq not to kill the Americans who were occupying their country, but instead to go and kill these other Sunnis who were coming in from Jordan and Syria and elsewhere. To fight against the Americans. And that was the period that they called the surge, where they sent in many, many more American soldiers, and they claimed that it was because of the surge that they won. Actually, what happened was that they went on a systematic campaign of murder, where the Joint Special Operations Command, under the leadership of General Stanley McChrystal, systematically began murdering anyone who even a sole source of intelligence would tell them was connected to al-Qaeda in Iraq or al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, and they killed a tremendous number of people. They lost count of how many people they had killed. At the same time, they were paying Sunni tribes not to shoot at the Americans, all the while building up a very corrupt bureaucracy under Nouri al-Maliki, who was put in power largely because of American wishes. You look now at the composition of ISIS. And certainly there, you know, there's this talk of the caliphate and al-Baghdadi and who is he. And it's not that there isn't a component to this group that is a very extreme Islamist movement that has a very arcane, raw interpretation, some would say a total misinterpretation of their faith. But there is a certain section of ISIS that definitely is motivated by the same factors that motivate suicide bombers from al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden's worldview. That's undeniable. But there's a whole other section, and my sense is that the actual military component of ISIS is made up of a core of people who were senior military officials in Saddam Hussein's military. And they were pseudo-nationalist Baathists, including the senior-most official from Saddam's regime, who is still at large. He was one of the guys on the deck of cards. He was a king on the deck of cards. And his name is Ibrahim al-Duri. Ibrahim al-Duri is a senior military commander of ISIS right now. Ibrahim al-Duri was a radical secularist who has nothing in common with the al-Baghdadi caliphate people, other than the fact that he's from the north of Iraq. He wants to get the foreign occupation out. He wants to get the Shia-led government out of his life completely. And they want to take over their territory the way that they had it when Saddam Hussein was in office. So it's not that they believe in the caliphate. It's not that they embrace the ideology that's projected about ISIS. It's that these were people who served in a military that was once militarily financed by the United States, who then fell out of favor with the United States, and then fell back into favor with the United States during the so-called surge or the awakening, and now are realizing that they're in a fight for their life. And they've been fighting essentially the same battle, flipping sides or having sides flipped on them consistently. Then you have the fact that the United States, when it left Iraq, left behind a tremendous amount of heavy ordnance and military equipment. People that are living in the 13th century don't know how to drive a tank. Where did they find people that know how to operate the tanks? know how to work some of the aircraft that they've taken, know how to work some of the advanced heat sensory weapon systems that they have. These are all people that were in Saddam Hussein's military. These are not radical jihadists who want to establish the caliphate. These are people that once were U.S. allies who now have been accidentally given all of this military equipment that was left by the United States. Airdrop somehow managed to make it into ISIS territory. So if you want to just boil this down to, oh, this is a battle of civilizations, and these are people that cut American journalists' heads off, and they're people that want the caliphate, certainly there's part of the story that has to do with wackos that believe in it, that they're establishing the caliphate. That's not even a fraction of the story here. Now, why did I just take all this time to explain this to you? Because if I believe that if we understood this on our news, if we had an understanding that, well, a big part of the ISIS threat, which, by the way, represents no existential threat to the United States whatsoever, that the big ISIS threat was in part created by our own policies, is in part blowback for what we unleashed around the world, that there are specific individuals who are now in the leadership militarily of ISIS that at a different time in history were U.S. allies. It's such a familiar story that we hear over and over and over again. The United States recently sent a general who is going to be in charge of training the good rebels in Syria. And he's this Brigadier General Michael Nagata. And he is a special ops guy who comes from the dark side of covert U.S. military action. His appointment to be the person who's going to train the good Syrian rebels was praised by General Stanley McChrystal, Admiral William McRaven, Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, all of the all-stars of America's covert military wars from the past several decades, said this guy is the perfect guy for the job. So he's going to go there and he's going to train the good Syrian rebels, and they're going to go and fight ISIS. I guarantee you, and it might not be a year from now or 2 years from now, but in our lifetime, we are going to feel blowback and see it in a real way for the troops that Brigadier General Michael Nagata is going and training on the ground right now, the same way that when the United States got in bed with Osama bin Laden and the so-called Arab Mujahideen in Afghanistan, it comes full circle and they come back and they attack the United States, or they are destabilizing countries in the region. It makes you wonder, the fact that this occurs so frequently throughout U.S. history, you wonder if there's some method in the madness, if there isn't something behind it where it's either they're incredibly stupid and incompetent, which could be the case in many ways and on some policies, or somebody somewhere has a longer strategic game for how they want to destabilize that region. And by keeping various factions killing each other, you ensure that eventually you're going to be able to walk right up the middle and take whatever you want. I'm not prone to undocumented, unverifiable conspiracy theories, but I'm putting out for you a thought that somewhere deep within the sort of caves of secret American foreign policy, the permanent bureaucracy that's never subjected to elections or Senate confirmation, that they are much longer term thinkers than any single candidate who comes into office. If there's ever a president that would dare to defy the national security apparatus, the national security apparatus that exists in the private sector and at the lower levels of the Pentagon and the CIA, they know that they can wait them out because they're not subjected to election or re-election, and they don't need to get money from their corporate sponsors and say the right thing at public town hall meetings. They're much longer term thinkers than anyone that ever resides in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And I bring that up because long ago in this country, a conspiracy was necessary to defraud the people. That big corporations, big media barons, politicians, they actively met to say, how can we suppress this information? How can we sell this bill of propaganda goods to the American people? How can we ensure that our corporate friends are constantly going to be making their money off of what we're selling to the world as a democratic process? The sick reality in our society right now is we don't need those kinds of conspiracies to have that same system thrive, because it's so ingrained now in our political system. I was saying last night that someone should propose a bill in Congress that requires any member of Congress to wear a NASCAR outfit with the logos of all their sponsors on it if they're getting money from corporations or wealthy individuals or hedge funds or what have you. Because if you think about it, what power do any of us have? Even, you know, if we collectively are together in a peace organization or a social justice movement, what power do we have to influence our local elected officials or our officials that we send to Washington, versus huge dollar donors who could in one fell swoop come in and say, I'm going to ensure you get elected every 2 years, Congresswoman, or I'm going to make sure you get elected every 6 years, Senator. The defense industry, big pharmaceutical, big energy, they all have infinitely more sway with our elected officials, even if not a single one of their executives lives in that district. That's corrupt to the bone. But that is how the system is designed now. The deck is entirely rigged against ordinary people. And they're always going to draw aces if they're working with the corporations. And they're going to have a gamble if they actually listen to their constituents. That's so rotten to the core that it should be the premier issue that all of us are working on, no matter what issues we work on a daily basis, whether you're concerned about the destruction of the environment by a collaboration of big corporations, powerful governments, and others, or it's war, or it's prisons, or it's police brutality. At the end of the day, the only way anything will fundamentally change is if corporations are removed from our electoral process. And if corporations were removed from our electoral process, we would have a multi-party system, because neither the Democrats nor the Republicans would be able to function without corporate sponsorship. And we would have something that would more accurately reflect the diversity of views in this country. You know, Amy Goodman likes to talk about the silenced majority, and the people who have no voice because of the way that the system is set up. And part of what she's talking about there is that if you have to constantly be choosing the lesser of two evils, if you have to constantly be saying, well, Congressperson so-and-so is really good on this issue, but I don't like them on that issue. If you actually could feel that you were voting for someone that reflected your values and you didn't have to hold your nose for them, it would change the whole political discourse in this country. But no corporations want that to happen. So we don't hear the full story or the historical context of the new enemy that we're told to fear. In fact, I shit you not, Brian Williams on NBC News, when he was announcing the Khorasan Group, had a graphic next to him, and you can find it on YouTube or on, you know, if you search images, that simply said the new enemy. And it could become like a, you know, I mean, at this point it's like a weekly holiday. I was going to say an annual holiday, a macabre one at that, but like where we announce the new threat. And it's Brian Williams comes on the news to tell us which new jihadist group we're going to fear and is going to come and take away our Christmas. And, you know, it sort of perfectly encapsulated it. Because you have a famous newsman, and he literally is sitting next to something that says the new threat. So it's, you know, happy Khorasan week, folks. And the media organizations, it's not just that they want to censor and stamp out coverage of this stuff. It's that advertisers don't want to pay to have their product put on next to dead kids. It's why Ted Koppel and Nightline are no longer on television. It's why reality television shows are the number one place where advertisers want to go. If you watch the advertisements on any given day, watching CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, you're gonna see a lot of ads for reverse mortgages, starring Fred Thompson. You're gonna see a hell of a lot of ads for Viagra and Cialis, and you're gonna see in the case of Fox a lot of ads telling you to buy gold because the scary black guy is president and you need to save it up for the day when he puts Chairman Mao in charge of our economic policy. But if you watch MTV or you watch the reality television shows, that's where like the big dollar advertisers are going. Why? Because that stuff sells. Keeping up with the Kardashians is lighthearted, and it makes you feel good about yourself because you're not screwed up in that way. But keeping up with the newest war, oh my God, slit my wrist. I don't want my Cheerio, Honey Nut Cheerios, to be next to showing a dead kid that we blew up in an errant missile strike in Yemen. But that's a big part of it. It's not that they have to go behind and say, let's cover up the fact that we're killing civilians in drone strikes. It's all the game. The rules are already agreed to. And anyone who comes into those positions in these media outlets is put into the meat grinder of the operation, and they get spit out with their soul s*** out of them. And so that's why we need independent journalism. So then you have independent journalism, and you have people fighting to do this, and you have great independent journalists who work for big corporate media outlets also, like James Risen of the New York Times. James Risen broke many of the biggest stories of the Bush-Cheney era about warrantless wiretapping, about acts of sabotage against Iran, and the U.S. government went after him. And there is a court case right now where James Risen is facing the prospect. He's a very famous Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. He is facing the prospect of going to prison for refusing to testify against one of his confidential sources. The phone records of the Associated Press, the team at the Associated Press that was doing the most aggressive investigation of the CIA's drone program, they had their phone records seized and their communications monitored. A couple of weeks ago, or actually last week, Yahoo News' Michael Isikoff reported that the FBI had raided the home of someone that they claim was my secret source for a series of stories that I did about the U.S. watchlisting program. Now, I'm not going to comment one way or another specifically about that because I believe in protecting sources. And if they raided the house of the wrong person, I'm not going to tell them. If they raided the house of the right person, I'm not going to tell them. I'm going to protect my source no matter what. But I'll say this. The Obama administration is a complete enemy to the independent free press in this country. They have prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all presidents in U.S. history combined. The Espionage Act was it was passed in 1916, 1917, but it was supposedly targeting people who were paid collaborators for Germany. But it was used then against labor organizers, social justice activists, people like Eugene Debs, to say that they were spies and that they were traitors to the United States. The Obama administration has started applying that act to people of conscience within government who pass documents or information to journalists without the permission of the higher-ups because they believe either that they're exposing criminality, that they're exposing unconstitutional activity, or that there are things being done in the name of the American people and with the dollars of the American people that the American people have a right to know about. Those are the people that they are aggressively going after, while all of the fraudsters from Wall Street who destroyed the economy are walking around as free men, while all of the torturers who designed the CIA black sites are walking around as free men, while the heads of mercenary companies that murdered civilians in Iraq are walking around as free men, they are putting people like Chelsea Manning in prison, like John Kiriakou in prison, ruining the life of Thomas Drake, an NSA whistleblower. He now works at the Apple store in Virginia instead of in government where he was for 30 years until he blew the whistle within the chain of command. Edward Snowden is in exile in Moscow. They say, well, why didn't Edward Snowden come back to face what he did? Why didn't he take credit for it? Edward Snowden watched them go after people who blew the whistle the way they said he should have, by going up the chain of command. And so he did the only thing that he felt that he could do, knowing that he could be killed, captured, put in prison for life, given the death penalty, also potentially captured by China or Russia or another government. And what he did at great personal risk to his own liberty. And I met Edward Snowden's father recently when Laura Poitras's film premiered in New York. And I encourage everyone to go and see that film because I've worked on the Snowden documents since from the beginning. And I thought I knew the whole story, but I didn't even know the half of it until I saw what actually took place in 8 days in that hotel room in Moscow. And it's mind-blowing, but it also gives lie to a lot of the bullshit that's been floated about who Edward Snowden actually is. And that's true of a lot of dissidents and whistleblowers. The campaign to destroy Chelsea Manning and her humanity was disgusting. You know that the Chelsea Manning was the leaked the WikiLeaks cables, hundreds of thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables. The collateral murder video showing a U.S. helicopter gunning down civilians and journalists in Western Iraq, the entire Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs. All of what Chelsea Manning did in leaking those documents was used by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, Der Spiegel, to sell their newspapers and sell their magazines. Not a single reporter from the New York Times covered Chelsea Manning's trial for months until they were shamed into doing so by the independent journalists who were covering that trial on a daily basis. CNN finally sent a producer down to sit in the courtroom at the tail end of Chelsea Manning's trial. This is one of the most significant trials in modern American history, and none of the media outlets that benefited from the leak showed up to cover the trial. CNN sends a producer down there to cover it, and this great, fantastic independent journalist, Alexa O'Brien, who's covering the trial every single day, just on her own website, started to live tweet all of the naps that the CNN producer was taking in the courtroom. And it was like, on some days, there'd be like 10 separate tweets saying, oh, Dan just went back to sleep again. And then he would wake up and ask her to tell him what happened. That's CNN, the most trusted name in news, is way of covering one of the most significant trials in modern American history is to send someone who clearly is not getting enough sleep at night to sleep during the trial and then get up and ask an unpaid reporter who's working her ass off, what happened today. And clearly he wasn't on Twitter because she kept doing it every day, tweeting his naps throughout the day. But to me, that says a lot about the state of our media in this country and where our priorities lie. James Risen is facing a prison sentence or prosecution for refusing to testify against a source. The government is saying that they're raiding my sources' homes. And again, I'm not saying whether they raided the right home or not. And journalists and whistleblowers alike are under the gun constantly. This administration is sending a message to reporters in this country, but also to the American public, that they don't want independent media. They want something that more closely reflects state media. They want everything to look like MSNBC, where the White House is great, Obama's fantastic, aren't Sasha and Malia cute, isn't everything peachy with the environment, and wouldn't it be nice if Obama could have a third term? They basically want us all to look like one long episode of, you know, the Rachel Maddow show. But that's not that, and I like Rachel Maddow in a lot of ways, but I also think that MSNBC carries a tremendous amount of water for the Democratic Party. We call it MSDNC. And you know, Fox News, it's boring to talk about because the reason Saturday Night Live doesn't cover Fox News is funny enough on its own. And then CNN actually now has a show called Wolf, hosted by Wolf Blitzer, talking about lone wolf terrorists, and the whole thing is just bizarre. But what they want is state media, because by prosecuting whistleblowers who give information that contradicts the official lies or the official policies, by going after them, they're saying no one is allowed to talk to the press unless we're doing it. After the Osama bin Laden operation was announced, John Brennan was leaking so much that the press should have bought him a Depends diaper, because he was telling everyone every detail about how bin Laden had grabbed his wife and pulled her body in front of him. That turned out to be total bullshit, that there was a firefight. No, that was totally bullshit. Almost every single thing that we were told about that operation later was contradicted. No one was prosecuted for those leaks because the leaks were intended to make the White House look good. But when someone says, hey, Verizon, AT&T, Google, AOL, there's back doors in their system that the NSA is able to access in order to dump and download all of your data, that's a crime. Why? Why is it that when propaganda is leaked that turns out to be a lie to try to make it one branch of the U.S. government look great, why is there no investigation of those leaks? But when someone actually leaks a document that members of Congress, that federal judges, that other governments around the world say, this is an outrage and should be investigated, that person is criminalized. It's because there's a war against journalism and there's a war against whistleblowers. So whoever the next president is, there's going to be no transformative president. There's going to be no rolling back of any of this. We're going to hear all sorts of stuff from Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. The fact that Bernie Sanders is running is going to make it interesting because he'll raise a lot of questions in the way that Dennis Kucinich did when he would run for the Democratic nomination. But at the end of the day, someone is going to be elected who is going to represent the hidden state the way that all presidents represent the hidden state. And the reason is very simple. It's because our elections are always bought and paid for by corporations, and it's a legitimized form of bribery. In other countries, you actually transfer a suitcase of cash to the dictator in return for giving you oil concessions. In this country, we allow corporations to do this openly, and we give it the stamp of legitimacy. And the only way it changes is if we change how elections take place in this country. And that's such an epic uphill battle. And that's why I credit groups like Chicago Area Peace Action and others who, as I was saying last night, have the audacity to say no in a time of universal yes. Yes, the Democrats are great. Yes, Hillary, run. Hillary Clinton is part of the same machine that Bill Clinton was part of. Rand Paul, even though he said some good things about, you know, drone strikes and other stuff, even the Tea Party can smell the bullshit there, that he's part of that same machine. And it's a bleak outlook that we have. And that's why I think that some combination of getting away from our computers for a substantial portion of every week and doing something in public in the presence of other people is a good start to try to take this on, because we sort of lost the steam over the last 10 years. But I remain hopeful. And part of why I remain hopeful is because of the kind of people I met last night and the kind of people that are here today. So with that, I'll end, and happy to take any questions or comments.
Go ahead.
So the question was about Al Jazeera and what I think of Al Jazeera, and also the situation with their journalists locked up. You know, I was in Egypt shortly after the Al Jazeera journalists were arrested. Now, there's three Al Jazeera journalists who work for the English language Al Jazeera. You know, there are multiple Al Jazeera networks. And part of the Al Jazeera Arabic language network has been kicked out of many countries in the period following what was called the Arab Spring. In fact, Al Jazeera as a whole had the rare distinction of being the only network kicked out of Iraq by both Saddam Hussein and George W. Bush, which probably meant they were doing something right. You know, but Al Jazeera Arabic and Al Jazeera English are different in their editorial tone, and there are many more Al Jazeera Arabic journalists in jail than there are Al Jazeera English journalists. I say that just because oftentimes we only talk about our colleagues who speak English or are reporting for Western media outlets. You know, if Richard Engel goes missing for 10 minutes, it's like they're talking about sending SEAL Team 6 in, when there are stringers working who are Arabs or Turks that are working for networks that have been kidnapped for years, and there's not an article in the paper about them in this country. So I want to preface what I'm going to say by saying that I think that it doesn't matter whether a journalist speaks in English, is a white person, or is speaking a different language and works for a media outlet none of us have ever heard of. All journalists that are being held by these repressive governments should be released. The specific case of these Al Jazeera journalists, Peter Gresty and Mohamed Fahmy, and their camera person whose name is eluding me right now, they are being prosecuted as engaging in some sort of espionage. Peter Gresty is one of the most experienced foreign correspondents in the world and has impeccable principles. The case is so ludicrous, and the idea that the Obama administration will embrace General Sisi in any way when this is the policy is shameful. It's shameful to watch U.S. officials hanging out and gallivant, palling around, as Sarah Palin likes to say, with dictators in that way. There's the war against journalists is real here and abroad. And abroad, it's much more dangerous in some ways because it's you could be killed, you could be tortured, you could be put in prison. There are 20 plus journalists right now missing in Syria. We heard about James Foley and Stephen Sotloff because they're Americans and they were beheaded. Iraqi journalists have been beheaded repeatedly over the past several months, and they almost never have their stories told on American television. There's an inherent sort of elitism, racism involved with our own coverage of our own industry. As for Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera English, when it first started, emerged as probably the best broadcast source of information in the world, and they had tremendous journalistic reach in terms of the kinds of people that they had. And I, like you, I got a lot of my information in terms of broadcast news from Al Jazeera English. When they got rid of Al Jazeera English in the United States and instead created Al Jazeera Americas, I think they made a huge mistake. Al Jazeera Americas seems like a smarter attempt to do what MSNBC, Fox, and CNN already do. And they hired, in fact, they hired a lot of their people came from CNN or MSNBC or other networks. So I've been disappointed with Al Jazeera Americas. Not to say there aren't some great people there, but Al Jazeera English, which unfortunately is blocked, you can use a VPN to get around and watch it. You can't even watch it online here without jumping through some hoops, is a much better representation of the Al Jazeera that you're talking about. I respect Al Jazeera tremendously, but there are different Al Jazeeras under the same umbrella that are a little bit different. Yeah, go ahead in the back. Yeah.
How about RT?
RT?
Yes.
I was on RT a few times when Ilona Minkowski was there, and I was on her show. In general, I don't like state-run media outlets, and I think, to the extent that I understand RT's coverage on things that that I've worked on, when they were covering Blackwater, I would report something that was the result of like meticulous investigative work, and I would take it to the exact point where I was reporting everything that I knew to be true, and then I would get some Google alert, and RT would have some bat crazy person on there talking about my report and then taking it into the realm of crazy and saying, you know, and Barack Obama personally did this thing and they have no evidence. So, I mean, in the areas that I cover, RT's coverage has been shameful propaganda. On the flip side of it, you know, I know a lot of people whose work has appeared on RT, and they cover issues that a lot of U.S. media outlets won't cover, or they provide a different perspective. So, like with anything, I think we should watch these networks with a grain of salt. I guess that's a way of saying that, to the limited extent that I know of RT's coverage, I would give them an F for their coverage of issues that I directly know about, and I would probably give them something closer to a C plus or B minus in the issues that I follow but aren't directly my reporting. But they're no different than CNN or MSNBC or any of these to me. I watch them all with a grain of salt. When I watch RT, I just assume part of what I'm getting is Putin's private whispers in my ear. Yeah, the question is about a recent UN report that cited that, I don't know if that's the exact number, but you said that people from over 80 countries have been coming to join ISIS, and whether or not that, I think that is in part in response to what U.S. policy has been about ISIS. Is that correct? Yeah. Could be. I mean, I think people probably would be drawn to join ISIS for any number of reasons. It could be young people who are living in Western European countries or in the United States that, I often think of what, like, why young people go to join some of these groups. And I think a lot of times people talk about it in the context of, you know, that this form of Islam has captured them and like they're in some kind of a trance or a cult. And I actually think of it, particularly with young people, more akin to the story of Columbine and the two kids that, you know, shot up Columbine and killed all of those kids. You know, a lot of the people that end up going to Somalia or Syria or Iraq from Western European countries or the United States, if you really dig into their story, they're teenagers who sort of become unmoored at some point, and they're looking for meaning in their life, and they're looking for answers in their life. And that is when recruitment is at its prime for any number of things. Evangelical groups try to do this too. And so, you know, you have these young people that are in a free fall, and who catches them? So I think that we put way too much emphasis on the fact that they are joining what is called a jihadist cause, and less emphasis on the very human fact of it is that they're lost kids looking for an answer, and someone gives them meaning to say, your people have been, you know, driven into the ground, there's a war against your religion, and your way of getting meaning in life is to do this. It's a similar tactic that ROTC and other recruiters use in this country, that you're trying to take advantage of people in a vulnerable position. But to directly answer your question, because I haven't been on the ground in Iraq for some time or in Syria, I can't directly answer that about ISIS. But what I do know is that in Yemen, where I traveled in Al-Qaeda-controlled territory, it did seem that a lot of the young people who were coming because there was a perception that that was the front line of jihad against crusaderism. And that that they wanted to come to the Arabian Peninsula because they felt like that was where the actual battle was happening. If you go back and read testimonials of young people who went to Afghanistan during the 1990s, when there were the warlord wars and the Taliban was rising to power, a lot of young people went to Afghanistan because they felt that that was the front line of the jihad. And a lot of preachers in Western Europe and the U.S. were saying this. In the 1990s, the U.S. was very happy to have young Muslims going to Bosnia, for instance, to fight, because the United States had staked its side out, saying that it was going to repel the Serbian forces and support the Croatian forces and then the Bosnian Muslims. So the U.S. once again was on the side of the bin Laden group in the 1990s in a conflict or a war in Europe. Today, I don't think it's necessarily that they believe that they're establishing the caliphate as much as it is a perception that they're fighting a war of religion. Because the U.S. has projected that message. So my guess would be that there probably are people motivated by a perception that the U.S. and its allies are in a war against their religion, and that they've been convinced in one way or another that that's the place for them to go to fight it.
Yeah. In the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, and how can we help?
I mean, the thing, often in our, I appreciate the question, just one thing briefly on Anwar al-Awlaki, people may know his story. I mean, he that's one of the main threads in my book and in one of the main stories in our film, Dirty Wars, is about sort of how the U.S. created this character who became, you know, one of the leading spokespeople for the cause of an armed struggle against the United States. And he was had a great affinity for al-Qaeda. And, you know, it's, the U.S. government has said things that I think have not been documented to be true about him being an official of al-Qaeda. I don't believe he was actually an official of al-Qaeda, but I think he agreed with the general worldview. In any case, they sentenced him to death and then executed him by drone without even charging him with a crime. And you know, it's a big part of my book is examining him. What's interesting is that Anwar al-Awlaki, though, no one had ever heard of him in the Arab-speaking world, in Arabic-speaking world in Yemen. He was a relative nobody. His father, actually, was far more famous than he was because his father, who's still alive and is a very respectable, wonderful man, his father had been a minister in the government of Yemen as the country was struggling to become unified. So his dad actually was very famous in the country. Anwar was primarily known because he scared American policy analysts, because he was speaking in English and saying things that were often far less radical than what he was cribbing off of that had been said in Arabic by far more articulate preachers who were speaking in Arabic. So it's sort of the power of nightmares at play there. And of course, the solution that the U.S. has to almost everything is militarism, is a military solution. We have a paramilitarization of law enforcement in this country. Well, weapons, systems, vehicles that we used in Afghanistan and Iraq come home. We donate them to local police forces. Police forces can put in a request to get that equipment. There's a Department of Homeland Security has a whole division. It's like Costco for military equipment, where you can actually get this equipment transferred to your local police department. When the Ebola outbreak began, the immediate U.S. response, and you contrast it with what Cuba's response was, but the U.S. response was to send 300 military advisors, and now that we're working our way up to 3,000 troops that are going to be there. We have a military solution to everything. Cuba sent 300 doctors, which is very interesting to contrast how we respond versus others. But in direct answer to your question about, you know, sort of how do you debate or discuss this in the public realm, oftentimes the starting point for all of these things is, oh my God, there's a crisis. This terrorist group is killing these people. These people are abducting 200 girls and you have to save our girls. And there's, you know, we start, you know, on chapter 20 of a book and we're constantly then having to, you know, we're presented with the you do nothing or we have a military solution. At some point, we have to hit the pause button on this and say, like, let's actually take a moment as a country. Why don't we have a commission? Why don't we have public hearings that looks at the origins of our role in creating all the problems we're telling the American people the solution for is militarism? You know, it's not that the United States or that any nation or people of goodwill don't want to. If I see a fight on the street, and I'm sure many people are like this, you know, you stop for a moment, you want to stop someone from beating someone up, but you take an assessment. You say, okay, this person has a knife. What's the best way to approach the situation? Do I try to call someone so that there's more of us to help? Do I actually intervene on it? Do I think someone's life is in danger? Do I use physical force? Do I grab someone to pull them off? There's no system for any of this, but there is a human response where you can look at it and you can say, okay, I'm looking at a horrible situation. What's the best way collectively that we think we should handle these things? We don't have that discussion in our society. We're just told it's either economic sanctions, which depending on how they're applied can be a mass weapon themselves, or it's militarism. And so we're all, you know, people of good faith who don't want to see mass slaughter happening and say we have to do something are put into this small box of opportunity where you're only told this way or this way. And the only way we break that cycle is if we collectively have a discussion in this country about how we should respond to those kinds of crises and get out of this sort of loop where it's just sanctions, militarism, do nothing. And you know, it's bankrupt. So I don't have a direct answer. And anytime, so what should we do about Kobani? What should we do about this? It's a setup. Because unless you're willing to at some point say, what do we do in general about this? What kind of society are we? Then we're always going to be faced with it's militarism or nothing. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm struck just even what you're saying now. What are these folks here going to do other than spit in the ocean?
Yeah. So your solution is?
I don't know that I've got one, yeah. But I'm just looking saying it's a rigged game.
I think if you go back and look at the tape, I said multiple times that I don't know. I don't know. I mean, what I'm interested in is a forum of ideas from people who actually care and are not, you know, p- paid to think by the makers of tanks, you know, as Naomi Klein describes the think tanks. But I mean, if I had an answer to that question, then I would probably run for office. And I don't think I'll ever have an answer to that question. But I think that part of what it means to be human, especially in times of eternal war, which you could say is the course of human history, means that you actually spend a good part of your life trying to struggle to change the way that things are. And you may not win the big victory. But I do think there are movements throughout history that have profound impact on society. And if I didn't believe that, then why wouldn't I just, you know, slit my wrists tomorrow or after I leave you here today? I mean, I do actually believe that it's worth, to be human in some form means to resist injustice in our thing. Right. Well, that's part of resisting injustice is to tell the truth. Yes, ma'am, you're so excited. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. You said earlier that a public stance is needed, getting out on the streets,
It's an interesting question because I think that, you know, if you look at the mass protests that took place in February of 2003, all across the globe, and I'm sure many of you in this room participated in marches in the Chicago area about this. I was in Baghdad at the time. You know, tens of millions of people across the globe, all at the same time, in the streets, marching against the war, and the war still went on. And they still did it. For a lot of people, I think that was a deflating moment where you felt like, you know, and I don't blame people, where you felt like we actually were on the verge of stopping something. And then John Kerry ran for president after it, and they just sucked the wind out of the room on that campaign. A lot of people just kind of fell in line and said, oh, well, you know, anybody but Bush. We just got to get Bush out of here. And that was what I saw as sort of the beginning of the disintegration of United for Peace and Justice, all of these other coalitions. It's not that they don't exist anymore. It's just the steam was just taken out of the thing and cast aside. So we're at ground zero in this discussion. And I hope it doesn't sound like I'm anything other than humble about where we are right now. Because I actually don't think that there's some one thing we could do or one coalition that we organize where tomorrow it results in action. Many, many months of work went into the climate marches in New York City, and there was much debate and internal fighting about whether they were too compliant with the authorities' requests and blah, blah, blah. But that kind of mass action takes many months of mobilization, and to what end? I mean, what is the point? And the thing is, I do actually think there's a point there. I think that we need to take a humility pill and look south in a global sense to see the kinds of alternative organizing and mobilization that's taking place, much of which is not about million-person mass actions, but is about acting in a local capacity. And I think there's a wisdom to that. I do think that, you know, as a parent of a teenager right now, I'm in New York City, I'm dealing with an atrocious system based on standardized tests, which is ultimately a class system where kids are winnowed out based on how responsible their parents are in getting them to certain things. Totally unjust, unfair system. And there's a growing revolt in New York City against the public testing, or against the standardized testing, as there is in other places. Those are winnable battles, and I think you cut your teeth in an organizing capacity when you start working on those. So, you know, I don't have any illusions about there's one set of demands we could all unify around and then we go into the streets tomorrow. It's a slow cook meal we burnt our last meal. So now we're at the beginning of starting to cook again. The flip side of it, which in a way contradicts what I said earlier, is that hackers and information activists, whistleblowers, they've been able to damage the armor of the machine more than a lot of direct action has in recent years. And I think it's something, there's a lot of really bright, principled young people. There are also some insane people if you look at Gamergate and all this stuff going on. But there's very exciting activism happening online, and there's a generational divide. If you talk to high school students about activism, they're talking about online stuff. They're looking at hackers. They're looking at takedown of certain websites and stuff. So somewhere in between the old model of direct action or mass mobilization, local organizing, and embracing a sort of new generation of activists whose activism largely exists on the internet. Somewhere in there, I think there's a formula that we need to study and work out, but I definitely don't have the answer to it. I do know that young people speak a totally different language than many of us, and it's our responsibility to figure out how to speak their language, not the other way around, you know, if we actually have any hope. In the way back there, and then we'll come back up. Yeah. I was going up that way, but that's fine. Then.
Sorry. We had a glimmer of, like, maybe we were winning a little bit a year ago when General Dempsey
General Dempsey is part of the machine, and, you know, no general in an active capacity is going to speak out in any public, meaningful way against an existing policy that the president has announced. I think you may be giving Dempsey a little bit too much credit based on the way it was reported in the media about Dempsey's position. My sense is that the sort of brass in the Pentagon and the senior military advisors speaking to Obama, their primary concern is they didn't want to send uniformed ground troops. I don't think that Dempsey's position on that was based on public opinion or mass mobilization or protest. I do believe that the political calculus that was done inside of the Oval Office was in part, it did take into account the fact that there was such widespread opposition to it. So I wouldn't pin it on Dempsey being the sort of convincing factor. Washington insiders are far more cynical than that narrative. And I think that, you know, when Rahm Emanuel, for instance, was the top advisor to Obama, I mean, Rahm Emanuel would often take national security issues, and instead of looking at, like, what do they think on a policy level is the safest policy, would actively be talking about how is this going to play with the voters versus, like, what is the right policy. So, you know, I think Dempsey and others in the Pentagon are not a fan of Obama's foreign policy and the way that he's used the U.S. military, and I would imagine it was much more motivated by preserving the interests of the military brass and what they thought was best versus a principled opposition. And so once the policy was announced, which admittedly is very few acknowledged U.S. boots on the ground, but using proxy war, private contractors, and air power, probably was what Dempsey actually was proposing in the first place rather than just lobbing missiles or sending in troops. So I appreciate the question, but I do think that it's part of that whole parallel structure. Dempsey has never had to be subjected to voters or re-election, and he's not going to just, at the end of a second term of a presidency, take some principled stance that's going to knock him out of favor with the military bureaucracy. So I think it's all insider politics there and not necessarily principled, but I do think activists impacted that, and it's a very good point. Sir, over there and then down here. Yeah. Well, I don't think any of those people would agree with you that they were engaged in non-resistance. Non-violence, I mean. Well, I'll also, I mean, not to get into a biblical argument, but I'll also remind you that Jesus went into the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers. And he also said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, which has been taken in a modern context to justify the payment of taxes to the empire. But if you read Daniel Berrigan or William Stringfellow or other theologians who are much more progressive, it's actually that nothing belongs to Caesar and therefore nothing should be rendered on Caesar. So we could play biblical ping pong all day. I can show you beat swords into plowshares and I can show you beat plowshares into swords because both of them exist in the Bible. But at the end of the day, I think that the point is that people like Dorothy Day were involved in one of the first mass acts of civil disobedience against the atomic bomb and then again against the hydrogen bomb. Catholic worker embraced a whole generation of people who destroyed government property by burning their A1 draft files. You know, I think that to imply that one biblical verse proves that Jesus didn't believe that you should resist the empire is weak sauce, because you can basically find any justification for anything in the Bible that you want. It's pretty clear, though, from the Bible that the character written about as Jesus was a quite revolutionary character who did believe in nonviolent direct action and didn't regard property as sacred as human life. But to take it out of the sort of theological and back into the discussion that we're having here, you know, there is a tremendous rich history of nonviolent direct action. And college campuses across the country, and I was involved with this when I was in college, you can win short-term victories through nonviolent direct action. But I don't think that non-resistance is an option. It's the question is what kind of resistance makes tactical sense and what kind of resistance makes moral sense, both individually and collectively. But I do think that the quote you're referring to, I don't think it's so much that the state has the monopoly on vengeance, that the state has a pretty solid monopoly on the use of organized mass violence. in part just because they own a disproportionate amount of the weapons in society. You know, we can talk about little guns until we're blue in the face and gun violence in Chicago or other cities. But if we don't talk about the connection of the little guns to the huge guns, to the wars that are being fought with our money and our moral codes and other things, then we're just, you know, whistling past the graveyard. So I appreciate the spirit of the question, but I also, in addition to disputing the theological interpretation, I think that all of the individuals that you mentioned are dead, and the reason that you're mentioning them is because they actually did have an impact, and the impact is being cited by you actually specifically. So, you know, I don't actually have an end to this statement, so I don't want to keep babbling, but I do think that resistance is important. Figuring out what the resistance looks like is our challenge. Yeah, go ahead, and then I'll be out there. And I
we're in a college campus, even though there's not a lot of students here.
Sorry.
There's some over here, but.
And one of the things that I notice about some of the discourse today is that people are very feeling know about it in this room.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because when I recently spoke at Peace Action in New York, and the average age was probably 70 or so, and I think, and no, I'm saying this just as a matter of fact, and I think that's in a lot of Peace Action chapters across the United States. There's a real struggle to recruit younger people to be a part of the organizing, and I'm not saying this as a piece of unconstructive criticism, because I think there's an ageism involved with that kind of characterization also, because I think, you know, many of the people that I meet at these Peace Action things are also totally dedicated, amazing peace activists, and they can't help the fact that they're older than you are. So and that's not some kind of crime against activism to have. I'm getting gray and white. Does that mean that I somehow am going to be like an afterthought of activism? No, I should be able to be valued for my activism no matter what my age. So I'm sensitive to that issue as someone who's sort of between where these guys are and between where somebody else is in the room that actually remembers the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but. But my, it's also how you approach young people. What I was saying before in response to the question about, you know, sort of the kinds of direct action and online activism and this other language that's being spoken, I think a lot of us that are getting up there, getting gray or already have gone totally gray, have to educate ourselves on how young people are accessing these issues. Divestment is a huge issue on college campuses. Net neutrality is a huge issue because it has to do with the future of how all young people are communicating now. You know, we should understand what it means to have a, you know, your daily story on Snapchat and all these, because we're not going to change that's how a lot of young people are communicating now, is online in short bursts. And you can stand in condemnation over it, or you can say, hey, there's a whole pool of people that actually probably have our same principles, but they're speaking a different language. And we need to find ways to reach out to them. And one of the great failures of the white, largely liberal, anti-war left for many, many years has been to find any common ground with communities of color. And, you know, when I go and I do events against the death penalty, I do events against prisons, against life without parole, against police shootings, and I will be in a room full of young people who are very engaged politically, and many of them went to Ferguson to respond to this. If I'm saying to them, you need to join our cause to be against the U.S. bombing that's going on against ISIS, but you have nothing to say about the fact that they feel that the police are waging a guerrilla war campaign against them in the streets and that the police are terrorists in their community, if you have nothing to say about that, if you have nothing to say about the death penalty or prisons or what's happening with young black men being targeted in communities across the country because they're young black men, if you have nothing to say about that, then don't be surprised if there's no young black men at your gathering. I'm not saying this at someone who did this. I'm saying I've seen this for years myself, and it's a big challenge. And I think the onus is on those of us who are in organizations or those of us that are older and complaining that younger people aren't around to figure out why. And not say, well, the young people don't care anymore. Oh, they do care. They just care in a format that you don't understand yet. So does that answer sort of...